And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. And we want to remind you that pencil and paper would not be an unwelcome thing to have handy, especially since there's a fair amount of information about to come your way. And if you're like me, you're not going to remember it all 2 minutes later. Let's start off with announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team, is announcing a special project. It's going to take place this Saturday, May 24th, from 9 a.m. to noon on the Coast Dairies property. This is a special project, and note that they will be meeting up at 9 a.m., which is an hour before their normal meetup time. Ken Moore from the Wildlands Restoration Team will be leading the project. Ken's been working at the Coast Dairy properties removing invasive non-native purple star thistle. The Coast Dairies property, owned for a century by the Coast Dairies and Land Company, a Swiss company, was the third largest privately held piece of California coast from San Francisco to the Mexican border. This unique 7,000-acre property surrounds the small town of Davenport and boasts six watersheds and more than 7 miles of coastal resources, including beaches, hundreds of acres of agricultural lands, redwood forests, and endangered species habitat. Come on out and give a helping hand protecting this spectacular land. How to get there? Due to no public access, we will be meeting up at the parking lot across from the Whale City Bakery in Davenport at 9 a.m. this Saturday, May 24th. And then we'll carpool from there to the restoration location. How to get to Davenport? Well, go north on Highway 1, 11 miles out of town. You'll see the bakery on the right. The parking lot is on your left. Once again, meet at 9 a.m. this Saturday up in Davenport. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. The program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80, wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring your gloves and your water. For more information, well, I'm not sure Linda knows what's going on, but you can try contacting her. 831-462-4041 or RedwoodRN, that's REDWDRN, at pacbell.net, or go to the website at www.cruisecnps.org. The Alameda Creek Alliance will be having their spring creek cleanup a week from Saturday, May 31st, or a week from Sunday, I guess. Help us clean up trash from known trout spawning habitat along Stony Brook Creek, and that's in the East Hills on the East Bay. Sunday, May 31st, they will meet at the dirt turnout at mile marker 8.75 on Palomares Road, about a mile up from Niles Canyon. There's a dirt turnout on the right as you come up the canyon, and an adopt the spot sign. Please bring clothes that can get dirty, gloves if you have them. They will have some gloves for those who don't have any, and sturdy shoes or boots are recommended. Note, this is a steep, rugged location. If you don't feel comfortable on uneven ground, this isn't the event for you. They'll get there in the morning. Once again, they didn't say what time it is. If you have any questions and what time they're going to start is one of them, please send an email to ralph@alamedacreek.org. Ralph@alamedacreek.org. And for more information, go to their webpage, www.alamedacreek.org. You get there by getting to Niles Canyon Road, either at Pleasanton End or the Fremont End, 4 miles down from Pleasanton, 2 miles up from Niles Canyon. Turn north on Palomares Road, and it's a mile up on the right. Energy Exports Action Camp is coming June 2nd through the 9th in Maryland. This from Chesapeake Earth First, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Do you have a distaste for mountaintop removal? The practice of turning mountains, often some of the oldest mountains in the world, into moonscapes, blowing them up bit by bit to get at the coal they hold inside, poisoning the ecosystems and communities downstream with slurry and sediment. What about fracking, where wells are typically cased in concrete, a material that will most always start to break apart within its first 100 years? Are used to pump millions of gallons of water, sand, and highly toxic chemicals deep into the ground, horizontally extending up to a mile or more, and forever poison any water source it comes in contact with? How do you feel about train derailments and pipeline spills that have been occurring and exploding at an increasingly regular basis all over North America? There is the one thing that is financing all of this and making it possible that these practices not only continue but grow, and that word is exports. This is why Chesapeake Earth First is working with activists from all over the region to host an Energy Exports Action Camp June 2nd through 9th at Prince George's County, Maryland. The camp will be situated between two of the largest coal export terminals on the East Coast in Baltimore, a destination for much of the coal coming from Appalachia, and what could be the first liquid natural gas export terminal in the eastern U.S. in Lusbee, Maryland. The destination for most of the gas coming from the Marcellus Shale and other eastern shale basins. At this camp, we will flesh out many of the specifics about what these export processes look like, what they contribute to, and how we can work to stop them. We'll be connecting dots along the entire life cycles of coal and oil, bringing together people who are living through the different aspects of these systems. Additionally, we'll have workshops on how to more effectively strategize our campaigns, ways to work the system to our advantage, technical skills we can use to take action, like blockades, climbing, creating compelling art, etc., and more on generally appreciating the wonders of this natural world we're working to protect. We'll be camping at a beautiful rural location with basic amenities from June 2nd through the 6th, then moving to a more urban and metro-accessible site from the 6th through the 9th of June. Each day we'll offer exciting workshops, panels, skill shares, three delicious meals, and lots of fun. We want to plant the seeds for creative, connected efforts for our ongoing resistance moving forward after this camp, and we'd really like to include you in that. Gather your friends and family and join us. The exact location and other details will be sent to you once you register. Kids are welcome. We will make every effort to meet accessibility and dietary needs. Day and part-time passes are available. We love animals, but the spaces we'll be in will not accommodate pets. So please leave them at home or with a friend. Find us online at energyexportactioncamp.wordpress.com. Once again, Energy Export Action Camp, that's exports, actioncamp.wordpress.com, and you can register there via a link. If you have any questions or thoughts, you can write us at energyexportscamp@riseup.net. We hope to see you soon. And the Earth First Climbers Guild is going to be having a climbing camp June 16th through the 22nd up in the Minnesota, Wisconsin area. They'll be in the Driftless area. Attendees will learn everything from the basics of ascending and descending a rope, setting anchors, to the more advanced skills of platform rigging and creating pod structures. All that's left is then to use these skills to stop the corporate ecocidal monster from destroying our bioregion, or yours, whatever, wherever that ecocidal monster is. What to bring? Pack like you're going camping, a sleeping bag, tent, rain gear, appropriate clothing for southern Minnesota in June. It's a little buggy, might be a little warm, might be a little cool, who knows. Good climbing shoes. These are any shoe with a stiff sole. No sandals, no bare feet. Gloves. Bike gloves are best, but anything snug and flexible will work. Pants you can climb in and be comfortable in. Loose, stretchy, breathable. If you've got climbing gear, bring it. If you've got food, bring that too. Not all Earth First Guild camps have communal kitchens, however, this one will. And you also should bring some money, $25 to $50 for the week, if you can. However, no one will be turned away for lack of funds. What don't bring? Dogs. Trust us, we love them, but climbing camp isn't the place. Drugs, like dogs, sometimes drugs are cool too, but not at a climbing camp. And leave your bad attitude at home too. They don't really want it, and it doesn't help keep people safe either. What they'll provide are knowledgeable trainers, climbing gear if you don't have your own, a full kitchen serving three meals a day, hooray, lots of details, directions, and a training schedule as the date approaches. Go to efclimbers.net. That's on the web, efclimbers.net. And also coming up in July, the 2014 Earth First Round River Rendezvous at the Klamath Knot, July 1st through the 7th. We are pleased to announce the summer's annual Earth First Round River Rendezvous will be held in southern Cascadia, western Oregon-California border region. It's critical time for our movement in the Pacific Northwest. And all kind of things are happening. We'll get into some of that in the news here. Yet, in the spirit of Cascadia, we are fighting back, sitting in trees, blocking roads, marching through the streets, howling in the offices and courtrooms, standing in solidarity with our friends. Come for the rendezvous week, stay for the Cascadian summer, and plug into regional campaigns. It's going to be held in the Klamath Knot, which contains 11 wilderness areas and amazing diversity of endemic plant species, and is the meeting place of three major mountain ranges, the Southern Cascades, the Sierra Nevada, and the Coast Range. There's also rumored to be a wandering lone wolf and his mate somewhere in the Klamath Mountains. Directions will get to you in mid-June. If you've never been to a rendezvous before, come expecting fireside songs and stories, hikes in the wilderness, workshops, group meals, friendship, and all kinds of rowdiness. Cascadia loves a party, and we can't wait to host. And if you want more information, go to www.2014rrr.org. I like to say that. It's a pirate radio station thing. 2014rrr.org. And green groups were banned from hearings on Alberta tar sands in this story from Common Dreams, as found in the Earth First Newswire. The Canadian province's ground zero for tar sands oil extraction has prohibited a coalition of environmental organizations from participating in regulatory hearings on a controversial new oil industry development, claiming that the green groups are not directly impacted by the project. The decision infuriated environmental campaigners who say Alberta's regulatory system is rigged to favor an oil industry that is wreaking havoc on the environment. Instead of addressing concerns about unchecked tar sands development, they are excluding concerned groups that are science-based and principled, said Carolyn Campbell, conservation specialist for the Alberta Wilderness Association, in an interview in Common Dreams. Oil Sands Environmental Coalition, comprised of several green groups, is seeking a voice on a proposed new Alberta development by Southern Pacific Resource Corporation. The project at issue is an in-situ development, which is where bitumen is too deep to strip mine and you drill and steam it out, according to Campbell. In a March 27th letter, Environment Alberta official Kevin Wilkinson denied the coalition standing to participate in provincial regulatory hearings regarding the project on the grounds that the coalition is not directly impacted, according to Bob Weber, writing for the Canadian Press. The coalition says such claims are false, especially given that their members have a recreation lease in the area of the proposed project. This is not the first time the coalition has been banned from such hearings. A similar prohibition in 2012 excluded the coalition from stating concerns about a development in the McKay River in northern Alberta, the Canadian Press reports. However, that prohibition was later overturned by a judge. Furthermore, Indigenous communities have been excluded from federal government panels reviewing tar sands developments that directly impact their environment and public health. There are so many exploration leases that are sold without any public scrutiny, said Campbell. The regulatory system is very tipped toward approving application after application to then develop these leases. We're surprised by this decision to deny standing to the Oil Sands Environmental Coalition again, especially since it was ruled that Alberta had wrongly excluded us before, Simon Dyer, Regional Director of Alberta and the North for the Pembina Institute, told Common Dreams. We will be challenging the decision and are confident we will be able to present our evidence at a hearing. And here in California, wood poaching. You've heard about it, but men have now been charged with slashing old-growth redwoods up in the North Coast. This story by Peter Fimwright of the San Francisco Chronicle. A suspected redwood tree slasher and burl bandit was arrested after park officials tracked the wood poacher and an accomplice to a Del Norte County shop where they allegedly peddled the purloined lumber. Oh, I love writing like that. Danny Garcia, 43, of Oreck up in Humboldt County, was charged with felony grand theft, vandalism, and receiving stolen property after the redwood burls he allegedly sold matched the large cuts found in a mutilated old-growth tree in Redwood National and State Parks in Humboldt County. His co-conspirator, Larry Morrow, 34, also of Oreck, was charged with the same crimes, according to Jeff Denny, a Redwoods Park ranger. Morrow was already being held in Humboldt County Jail on unrelated charges when he was booked on the burl banditry rap. We have successfully identified at least two individuals we feel are responsible for this crime, Denny said. However, we are not under the impression that these are the only individuals involved in this kind of activity in the park. burl poaching, which involves cutting the valuable knobby growths at the base of redwood trees, is a growing problem in far northern California, where most of the state's existing old-growth trees remain. The ancient growths are prized by woodworkers because of their intricate ring patterns and are often used to make tables, furniture, knife handles, trinkets, and other lumber products. Depending on the size and quantity, the wood burl can be sold for anywhere from $200 to $2,000, said Denny. The money is a strong lure in rural areas where lumber mills have recently closed down, jobs are scarce, and drug addiction is a growing problem. The remote areas of the Redwood National and State Parks have been a particular draw for poachers renting ATVs and carrying chainsaws. The 133,000-acre park contains almost 40% of the world's remaining old-growth redwoods. There is a financial incentive, Denny said. Burl is being sold internationally as well as in the local market. The latest investigation began on April 19th last year when a bear researcher found several massive cuts in an old-growth tree along the Redwood Creek drainage in the southern end of the park. The largest cut measured 8.3 feet at the base, 8.2 feet in height, and was 1.7 feet deep, Denny said. The culprits cut the burls into slabs weighing more than 100 pounds each, dragged them several hundred yards to a road. They were so large that some of them were left behind. Denny said rangers monitored the tree, but the bandits somehow managed to sneak back and make off with the rest of the burl booty. Park officials soon received an anonymous tip that the burls had been sold to a tourist shop in Del Norte County, where investigators obtained Garcia and Moro's names on the receipts for the sale. Denny said rangers were able to match the burl cuts to the cuts in the tree. In this particular case, we were fortunate to have the raw material that had not yet been cut up and turned into a different shape, Denny said. In this case, we had exact matches of the shape and size. The 10-foot diameter redwood tree was badly damaged, but is expected to survive. The problem is that the sprouts from burls are an important part of redwood regeneration, and researchers say the sources of the Latin name for coast redwood, Sequoia sempervirens, or forever living. We've had a half a dozen other incidents of these very large cuts within the last 2 years, and we're documenting other wood poaching in the park, Denny said. It is our hope that we can stem the tide of this type of crime, show people we are working to protect their parks, and let the public know that this is a significant problem in our parks. And a bittersweet megalod victory sends mammoth packing in this story from the Earth First Newswire. Wild Idaho rising tide, no shipments, Missoula, Northern Rockies rising tide, and other allies won another crucial victory in the struggle against megalods. According to an email released by the Idaho Transportation Department, megalod hauler mammoth has pulled out of highways 95 and 200. An email from Chip Kachel of Mammoth states, please cancel all permits involving Mammoth USA routing to Great Falls, Montana from the port of Wilma, Washington via Idaho and U.S. Highway 95 and Idaho Highway 200. On their Facebook page, West Wild Idaho Rising Tide declared the news a bittersweet megalode victory. Megalode haulers initially chose Highway 95 during controversy surrounding their usage of Highway 12 in March of 2011. That same month, Earth First joined Northern Rockies Rising Tide at Lolo Hot Springs, Montana, and demonstrated against megalodes and pipelines by storming Governor Schweitzer's office and dancing on his table. The megalod plan was to begin by barging megalodes to the port of Lewiston, Idaho, from the port of Vancouver, Washington. Megalodes would then rip through the town of Moscow on their way to Highway 200, which unravels through the majestic Blackfoot Valley towards the Alberta tar sands. Imperial Oil was issued an injunction against hauling megalodes through Highway 200 by July 2011 following a lawsuit. While the recent victory is important, it is important to stay aware. According to one activist, Mammoth may have a plan B up their sleeve. When megalodes were stopped from running up Highway 12 via a blockade and ensuing legal victory won by the Nez Perce and their allies, another hauling company called Omega Morgan decided to try to run megalodes through eastern Oregon. Despite being blockaded and protested numerous times by activists with Rising Tide groups throughout Cascadia last winter, the haulers may decide to devote their efforts to this Plan B route for as long as they can. Wherever they go, they know they will meet costly resistance. And dozens of pheasants have been released by the Animal Liberation Front in a story received anonymously in Biteback, as found on the Earth First Newswire. On the morning of May 20th, a visit was paid to Gervais Game Bird Farm, the address 6565 St. Louis Road Northeast in Gervais, Oregon. This farm breeds game birds, both for slaughter and to be sold to canned hunting operations. A flight pen located at the edge of the property had its gate pried open, giving dozens of captive ringneck pheasants a chance to fly off into the countryside. Unfortunately, due to logistical concerns, the remaining pens and enclosures on the farm, which imprisoned quail and partridge, were unable to be breached. Tonight, Direct Action was able to give a few animals a chance at freedom, but there is no solace in the knowledge that some were left behind. Ringneck pheasants are a naturalized species to the Willamette Valley, and those bred on farms retain the natural instincts necessary for survival in the wild. In solidarity with Animal Liberation prisoner Kevin O'Liff and the Silent Ones on the Run for Anarchy and Animal Liberation, the Animal Liberation Front. And a Russian Animal Liberation Front cell has targeted an equestrian center. The story was also received anonymously in Biteback, as found on the Earth First Newswire. On the dawn of the 17th of May, huge flames lighted up the territory of Leonozovsk on the northeast side of Moscow. The horse shed belonging to an equestrian center of specialized children and youth sports school of the Olympic Reserve, Matador, was burned. The fire of vengeance was set by activists of Animal Liberation Front. This action took place on the day of the beginning of the equestrian center contests and became the first and last warning to senior handler of Matador, Sergei Nukulin. On the 17th and 18th of May, there were to be contests here in which the horses of Matador will mainly participate. The contests always bring big money to the pockets of Sergei Nukulin because people pay not only the entrance fees but also to visit the center to train for a month before the contests. Every participant spends hundreds of thousands of rubles. Everyone benefits from this situation except the horses, because handlers and riders put them through the ringer. The main goal of the Matador owners is to make as much money as possible, and they are not interested in the future of the horses as they bring in much more profit to Nukulin than they cost. Just a few words about the senior handler, Sergei Nukulin. This person has abused horses for many years, crippling them, which he uses only as a tool of gaining money. Any love to animals is out of the question. Furthermore, this person has obvious mental abnormalities that prevent him from working with animals. In other words, the horses of Matador have become the hostages of human greed and apathy. And almost no one sees the horror of what happens behind the doors of the shed that houses 28 horses. No one looks into the eyes of these animals that suffer of pain, of hunger and pain. No one knows how they live in their prison wards where they can only stand at attention the whole day long without any possibility to move, to turn, or to lay down. Most of them have flanks rubbed sore in attempts to move somehow in their cages, which are more suited for big dogs. These horses never walk free. They come out only to give a ride to happy people on their wounded backs with saddles that do not fit their sizes. They endure pain in their legs, backs, and ripped mouths because otherwise they will be beaten up and punished by deprivation of food, which they will get just a little bit of anyway normally. Not long ago, a pony was beaten up because he dropped a 2-year-old child. In the wild, nature horses feed about 16 to 19 hours a day, constantly moving. In Matador, they are fed with miserable quantities of hay in the morning and in the evening and oats for lunch. On weekdays, they don't get to have the lunch because there are so many people coming for a ride. But who sees the terrible emaciation and open wounds in the backs of these prisoners under the colored horse blankets and shiny saddles? Even if someone notices them, the handler will say that everything is okay, that horses just have this kind of body structure, a sport one. Look into any cage of these horses or ponies in this equestrian center. They have a dirty mess on the floor instead of dry straw. You won't see any hay there and understand how cramped these animals feel themselves. Imagine what will happen if fire occurs, and fire will certainly occur one day, taking into account this pile of straw and hay stored directly near the walls of the stable. In case of fire, all these horses will burn alive because it will be impossible to take them out of such narrow premises. Look into the eyes of these weary and exhausted horses who stand for hours saddled in their tiny stalls waiting for clients, and you will understand everything. We will no longer tolerate the abuse of animal oppressors under the guidance of Nicolin. Today we have burned only a horse box, but it was just a warning. We say hello to Nicolin and claim that if he and his team won't stop doing any activity connected with animals, then the next time it won't be a car that will burn. If all the horses aren't sold and Nicolin won't stop his cruel activity by the end of the year, then we will do everything we can to stop animal suffering. Signed, Animal Liberation Front, Russia. And police are seeking steelhead bandits who released 25,000 fish from a Washington hatchery in this story by Gary Chittum, King 5 News, and found on the Earth First Newswire. Washington State's five steelhead hatcheries are on high alert after someone broke into a facility overnight and released approximately 25,000 juvenile fish into the Snoqualmie River. State Fish and Wildlife hatchery managers are concerned that it was an act of defiance against a new agreement that sharply curtails the state's steelhead hatchery program. The agreement resulted from a lawsuit filed by a fish protection group, Wild Fish Conservancy, which accused the state of violating the Endangered Species Act. State Fish and Wildlife managers agreed to stop planting winter steelhead hatchery fish in all but one river. This set off a wave of criticism by some sport anglers who eagerly await the steelhead runs each year. It also left the state with huge numbers of steelhead that could not be released into tributaries of Puget Sound. Whoever struck the Tuckle Creek facility on the Snoqualmie appeared to know the hatchery was planning to truck its large inventory of steelhead to the east side of the state, where they would be released into lakes that would not allow them to migrate to the Sound. State Fish and Wildlife Enforcement officers and King County Sheriff's deputies are investigating the break-in. Hatchery workers say whoever did it cut the lock off a tall chain-link fence, entered the hatchery grounds, and pulled the screens that prevented the steelhead from entering the creek and Snoqualmie River. Private security officers have been hired to patrol other hatcheries until police figure out if this is an isolated case or part of an organized resistance to the settlement. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you want to listen to a rebroadcast of this program, you can tune in tomorrow afternoon right here on Free Radio at 3 o'clock. You could also tune in Monday nights at 9:30 to KRFP in Radio Free Moscow, Idaho, 90.3 FM, their new high-power frequency, or you could go to radio4all.net on the web. That's radio4all.net. And please support radio4all.net if you can. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.